Morning. So Joni Mitchell and Simon and Garfunkel in about a 10-minute span and a dance floor, that's when you know you're in the right place at the right time. So pretty cool. C3 just keeps rolling along. That's great. Thanks for having me again. This is part one of a two-part. So if I see you again next Sunday, I'll know everything went well. If not, then clearly you've missed something, and I'm sorry. So I teach ethics, mostly for MBA and EMBA students. You might have heard, too, that there's an election coming up. So fortunately, we're in a country where we can have calm, reasoned, informed conversations about really difficult, hot-button issues. So we'll perpetuate that here today. The thing about, there are lots of things about being an ethics professor. One is a conversation stopper. Two, if you mention it, you know, out loud to anybody. But there's, you know, for good or ill, there's never any lack of material. Governments, institutions, individuals, they just keep making more and more material. Sometimes I feel like Lucy, you know, in that famous chocolate thing. It's like, DEI, artificial intelligence, you know, blah, I can't keep up. But there's just one thing after another. So what I'm hoping to do today and a little bit next week, too, is just use a couple of different hot-button issues to talk about some ethical reasoning in ways that that at least I try to go about letting people know that while they're skeptical that anybody can teach ethics, right? That's one of the other questions. Well, you can't really teach ethics, right? You can teach finance and you can teach economics. So you can't teach ethics, right? Well, why not? Well, because we all got that from our families and our churches and our, okay, well, how did they get it to you? Well, they taught us. It's like, oh, okay. So there's a sort of built-in irony or conundrum there. But my business is not really to teach people, you know, I've looked into your soul, and it's about a C+, and I'm going to try to bring it up to like a B, you know, by the time we get done with this. It's to introduce people to ways of thinking about the stuff where, you know, you can at least some appreciation for our irrational, non-rational, and rational ways of going about making moral deliberations and perpetuating, as you say, if not resolving things, at least becoming increasingly comfortable with the fact that we don't have any answers. The stuff has to be revisited on a regular basis. And if that doesn't work, since it's a dance floor here, people are always welcome to do an interpretive dance. It's like, I just don't feel. Manuel Kant makes me tired. So, all right. So I'm going to use, one last thing in terms of the meditation. It does make me want to do a talk on, that's so presumptuous of me too. It's like, yes, I must do a talk because I have something to say on what compassion demands, right? Especially in the Buddhist tradition, there's always that open-ended question about, all right, what is compassion? How do you get it? And then what does it demand of you? What do you actually do with it? And Gaylock Rinpoche, one of my teachers from Ann Arbor, was sometimes very quite cutting and quite harsh, like I learned a lot of Tibetan teachers are, in that the compassion sometimes was to basically to help you face the fact that you were an idiot and you might want to think about not being an idiot. But it was unlikely for you to understand that you were not in, or that you were being an idiot unless somebody told you that directly. So it was very Dutch in that way. So, which I was familiar with. So that was great. All right, so I'm going to use affirmative action here today as the hot-button issue. Why? My teaching is starting next week, and it's a perennial. Right? There are lots of issues that come AI. Oh, AI, it's all new. We don't know what to think. Bioethics, we don't know what to think. It's all new. Technology is new. But then there are the perennial ones, too. And affirmative action is very much back in the news, of course, from the 2023, last year's decision by the Supreme Court, both in the Harvard and UNC cases, in terms of where they found the universities were in violation of the 14th Amendment, and they didn't have a sunset clause, which meant that, in other words, they didn't have an idea in mind of when they would be able to end their affirmative action programs, that it wasn't the kind of, it didn't pass strict scrutiny tests. In other words, it was too broad, wasn't being applied judiciously or fairly, and essentially gutted it, right, with fairly predictable results, in which members of both the Black community and Hispanic community are now going to be underrepresented in especially elite colleges, but across the board in the country, in statistically significant numbers. So what's going on there? Well, if you're a conservative commentator, like somebody like Ben Shapiro, has anybody ever forced themselves to watch these folks? Charlie Kirk and those guys? Well, right. All right. I'm not giving voice to them. We're talking about them. Well, the problem is clearly cultural, right? There's something wrong in those communities, and they need to fix it. It's not the problem for everybody else, you know? All right, what else is going on? The original impetus for affirmative action, as many of you know, take you back to the late 1950s and early 1960s, when all these programs were being put into place, was this question of, gee, is racism, discrimination, prejudice, ostracism, is it real? Is there any way for us to know, is it real? The felt perception, at least by the majority, was it was. All right, should we remedy that? How would we do that? Affirmative action and its myriad of programs comes into place, and lots of people throw up their hands and go, well, this is it's very Churchillian. It's like, this is probably the worst remedy for racism ever, except all the other ones. Right? And it actually has a fairly, positive effect. White women, black women, black men, more or less in that order, were the greatest beneficiaries in the first 20 to 20, 30 years, leading up to the Bakke case, 1977. And this is, in some ways, the heart of the issue. I don't know if you woke up this morning thinking, boy, I sure hope there's a history lesson on affirmative action this morning. The Bakke case in 77, where you might remember Alan Bakke, the pre-med student, wants to go to UC Davis, is denied on the basis of affirmative action, files suit, goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And at the time, in the Supreme Court deliberations, a couple of Douglas and a couple of the other, Potter, they go to Thurgood Marshall, who's the only black member of the court at the time, and they say, look, we're sort of uneasy about this. We don't know how this plays with the 14th Amendment, blah, blah, blah. Said, but, the Constitution does seem to allow for, immediate or short-term remedies. How long do you think it would take, if we actually vote affirmatively in this case? And Marshall looks at them and he says, it's going to take about 100 years. And they both, reportedly fall off their chairs. And they think, 100 years. And then, right, this comes back to the Gooder decision later in the 2000s, where Sandra Day O'Connor and the University of Michigan case, right, what's going to happen here in Michigan, and she's got it down to 25 years. She said, well, we probably can and should perpetuate this. It's a good program. It's having the kinds of effects we want to curb lack of opportunities, overt racism, hostility, lack of opportunities, et cetera. So let's do, 25 years. Well, we got impatient. that ended a little bit before her 25-year window. So there is now back on the table, especially an awful lot of businesses are sort of back and forth on this as I'm looking at it. It's like, well, that decreases our talent pool. It decreases the number of the possibility for diversity. That's bad. These are bad things. And at the same time, they won't say this out loud, but they're quiet. Many of them are quietly doing this. Oh, good, this gives us cover to cut our DEI programs. So there's a lot of confusion, a lot of conflict. What does this really mean? What should we do? What's the right thing to do? Teach a lot of people who are already business managers, if not leaders, kind of struggling with this. We know we should be on the side of diversity. We know we should be on the side of equal opportunity, but we're also up against certain prevailing cultural winds and economic resources and questions of meritocracy. What do we do? How do we think through this business? So one of the questions to start with is, look, you know, are sexism and racism still real? Do they still exist? Right? And maybe you would be surprised, maybe you wouldn't be surprised at the myriad of answers that I get when I ask people. No, everything from absolutely not. Those things are dead in the water. We've solved those problems for all time. Anybody who suffers any kind of discrimination at this point, it's their own fault. I mean, they just must be unlikable in some way. For that, seriously, sincerely held positions. Two, yes, it's still terrible, and we need to do all kinds of remedies. But the question, as the question is for so many things these days, as a colleague of mine put it, said the true problem of our era is epistemology, which is, given all the competing notions of reality, all the competing sources, how do you figure out, you know, what's credible and what do you go with? So to that extent, in this, I'm putting my career on the line, and I'm using this book. And for those of you who have been here before and heard me speak, you won't be surprised at references to books. It's kind of where I live. Some of you may or may not be familiar with this book, Everybody Lies, the DeWittowitz book. It was a bestseller, came out in 2017. He was a data scientist at Google and something of a social scientist. And he said, how would we really find out, you know, what's true about Americans these days? And the way you used to do that was, you know, you'd be a researcher and you'd give beer money to 21-year-olds, you know, an N of, you know, between 50 and 80, and you'd give them surveys and put them in a lab and hook them up to one thing or another, and you'd have relatively small sample sizes out of which you'd make very large generalizations. This is what people, this is what 21-year-old beer drinkers are like. They don't say that. This is what Americans are like. And his revelation, his innovation, if you like, was, no, Google and the internet have just given us the best possible survey results ever known to humankind. We don't have to and should not listen to what people say when you ask them what their preferences are, how they would vote, how would they would do one thing or another. Surveys are not terribly helpful. All we have to do is look at Google Trends and like sort of internet models, and take this huge, amazing amount of data, which is it's only confidential in the sense that your name is not attached to it, right? You all know that. Well, some of you might have your name attached to it. I'm sorry. That's you should be careful about that. but there's just a tremendous amount of data out there, right, on what we say and what we do, and what we, more importantly, what we search for. And one, I mean, the book is chock full of all kinds of controversial and provocative statements or findings, things that debunk various myths about who and what we are, what we care about. But one of them, right off the bat, that became, you know, headline news was that he looked at searches done throughout regions of this country where people looked for the N-word. And in the book, he doesn't use N dash dash dash. I mean, he puts the word in, which is, if you're at academia, is shocking at this point because, man, that's a career ender like that. You can't. I mean, even law school professors who are reading case law cannot use that word. It's right. So he's very in your face, and I'm thinking, let's say, so meeting my students next week, I can't wait to see how it goes. But the point is this, and it's an incredibly important one, is that he's making a strong correlation bordering on causality. He's saying in parts of the country where there was a high degree, 25, 30, 40% of the population regularly searched for or used that word in searches, correlated across the board to voting for Trump or other conservative, like-minded, hard right candidates. So you'd say, okay, well, that's not surprising. But the point is, the data wasn't there before this, right? And he does this across the board, where you can predict all kinds of things now, according to him, if you follow the trend lines in Google Trends on what people search for. You get a pretty good sense of everything from the rates of pedophilia to who they're going to vote for to, you know, how much money people make to what kind of jobs they want. I mean, it's just an astounding treasure trove of data and possible predictable results. So on the basis of that, we're going to use some of the findings from this book and others to suggest that maybe affirmative action's time isn't done. Well, as we're thinking about it, what did affirmative action actually set out to do, especially with the university? One, overcome test gaps problems. So testing was thought to be skewed absolutely in favor of people who looked like me who came from my background. That seemed to be largely corroborated. Two, make up for past wrongs. Look, if you never give anybody the opportunity, you shouldn't be surprised that they don't do especially well. Having remedial or other kinds of equal opportunity programs in place. Grand Valley's struggling with this right now. We are doing our best to buck, in lots of ways, national trends, you know, against DEI or affirmative action. And in fact, I'm quite proud of the university for the number of programs in which it's, you know, trying to extend opportunities. We just put the cart before the horse in some ways. We didn't necessarily have all of the support programs in place that we might have culturally, academically, et cetera. So working on that. And the third one was to essentially diversify, right? That it's very difficult to encourage, to get the best out of all your citizenry if the very best positions are dominated only by people who look like me. So those all seemed like fairly compelling reasons. So you go through them and you say, all right, diversity question, you know, what's fair or good or advantageous about diversity? On the face of it, is it a good thing? It turns out for businesses, I'll just make the business case, actually, yeah. You know, pretty good research out of the University of Michigan and other places where if you've got folks from lots of different backgrounds, coming from lots of different places, lots of different points of view, your problem-solving ability goes up. That's well documented. Creative approaches coming out of conflict and different perspectives, you don't. So again, you might say, well, that should have been obvious. It wasn't obvious to anybody. Two, the testing gaps, the diversity, the attempts to address past wrongs. The question of fairness is, look, what kind of potential is here? What kind of talent are we missing? We can build in programs that include people who were otherwise marginally excluded or, you know, intentionally excluded based on nothing other than the color of their skin. Anybody with a half a bit of empathy, right, or some sensibility about what it means to be human can imagine, at least for a second, what it might mean to be excluded solely on factors you can't control. So let's address that, okay? All right, so what's the problem? Well, if you take that away, say what the UNC and Harvard decisions said, this is a violation of the 14th Amendment. This is clearly discriminatory towards everybody else. It raises the question then of, is there any impetus to continue to support programs that in fact still offer opportunities for advancement based on equality of opportunity? And I think you see in some of the political conversations that are going on, the answer to that is no, not necessarily. Head Start would be on the chopping block. It's giving cover, this kind of approach, to undermine or undercut all kinds of programs that would go against what most Americans say they actually do believe in, equality of opportunity, that when you give them a chance to act on it, it turns out to be a little more split than that. Which again is one of the, I think, beauties of this particular book, which is do not trust what anybody says. Ask to see the last 6 months of their Google search. See, if they're initially or even persistently reluctant to open up their computer and show you what they've searched for the last 6 months, aha, you've got them. All right. I want to go into this because what are you hoping to achieve actually in ethics classes? And, you know, become familiar with the history of ethics, you know, what Immanuel Kant thinks and all that sort of stuff. I do think there's a certain amount of value in that. But for me, the behavioral side of it is equal, if not more important. What do people actually do, think, and act? And it's interesting. When I had for about 2 years, I was facilitating a conversation in Grand Rapids between white and black leaders, community leaders, business leaders, et cetera. And what I wanted was a respectful but no holds barred conversation, because Grand Rapids is a bastion of, I mean, in some ways it's the epitome of of the disparity between what we say and what we do. And it's, yeah. This is also very weird because this is very much like a Grand Valley Classic, I got to tell you. There's like one or two people from the black community where I'm going, oh God, you know, it's like, oh, it's, you know, hey, isn't diversity a great thing? Sure, take a look around, yeah. But anyway, so what I've seen happen, that conversation is now 6 or 7 years old, we're not currently engaging in it, but the right, it seems to me, has gone more and more towards the no holds barred part of the conversation. Now we can say anything, you know, we don't even worry about respect, people's feelings, politeness. But the left, to be fair, has gone to this point where we're going to be so respectful that we're not going to say anything, all right? And out of fear of, you know, maybe harming somebody's delicate sensibilities. So my classroom, unique and alone in the entire world, as far as I can tell, no, I'm kidding, we're hoping to engender a respectful, no holds barred conversation. So far, I'm still there. I'm teaching there. So far, so good. But this question of respect but no holds barred means you've got to go into the science, right? You've got to, even if it's tentative, even if you understand, and those of you who heard me before, it's like, oh my God, he's going to talk about science again. I can't believe. But what do we actually know about the underpinnings of racism? A book like this can tell us who's racist, where they're racist, how they're being racist, what they search for, but it can't really tell us much about the underpinnings. So in what I have been trying to argue for a long time is if epistemology is truly the question, then you've got to leave a class like mine, and I hope many, many others, asking yourself, all right, what don't I know before I weigh in on this, you know? I come to immediate judgments. We know that. We all come to immediate judgments, but get that. But then that's the non-rational part. That's just the limbic system surviving. It's like threat, not threat, you know, and, you know, doing the feedback loop with the amygdala and going, should I get the hell out of here? Do you seem like a relatively safe group? I don't know, you know. I'm going to trust you here for a minute. But and then, right, 40,000 years ago, cerebral cortex finally fills in. For women, you know, it's in our particular evolutionary period, it's complete around 23. For men, around 70. So, no, just joking. Yes, I think the sciences were maybe a year or two behind. But if you ask my daughters, they would go, "No, I'm thinking 70." So. So we can. We do have this rational part. We can combine all these things. We have got the ability to reflect on this sort of stuff. So what do we need to know? Well, it turns out, and again, I'm telling you stuff you already know. My apologies. But it's worth contemplating this every time a policy issue, a hot-button issue like affirmative action comes up, which is, all right, what does racism come from anyway? Right? Are we hardwired? Are we born? You know, is it taught? How does all this stuff happen? It turns out there is, according to the most recent best science, corroborated science, there is an innate ability to differentiate between us and them. That's just there, right? And then, depending on what kind of culture you're born into, the dominant us-them differentiations will be the ones ascribed to that particular innate quality. In other words, if I'm born in the Middle East, I'm probably not so much attuned to culture as I am, or I'm sorry, to color, as I am to culture and religion affiliations or history or ancestry, right? In parts of Asia, that's true as well. If I'm born in this country with our particular and peculiar history, then I'm probably going to be much more India, probably much more attuned to color lines and color divisions and making distinctions and judgments very quickly about threats, possibilities, opportunities, proximities, et cetera, based on color as opposed to culture, necessarily education or religion. So what happens with that particular kind of information? Can you do anything about it, or are we doomed for all time? Well, affirmative action shows that actually you can, and it is proximity. And the best experiment, as I get closer to my time here that I'll leave you with, is Charlotte Mecklenburg, North Carolina, one of the longest, three generations of school integration as a kind of offshoot of, you know, one of these affirmative action programs. What happened there in the first generation was a lot of conflict, largely poorer black community,
being integrated into largely wealthier and white communities. How did it go? There was the usual amount of back and forth, tension, some violence. It was the first generation was not easy. Nobody's making any bones about that. But by the second generation, they're pretty proud of what they're doing. Everybody's getting good results. College applications and admissions are way up. Health and well-being, every measure you're looking at is going up. President Ronald Reagan stops by on his re-election tour, and cluelessly, none of his aides apparently mentioned this, gives this rousing speech to the citizens of Charlotte-Mecklenburg saying, and we'll do away with these kinds of, you know, busing and integration that's so deleterious to the community. He didn't use that word, of course, but sorry. And there's just dead silence in the community. There are a few thousand people, you know, there, and he's getting all these applause lines, and he's saying, well, you know, we're going to end this kind of affirmative action nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And everybody's going, all right? And there's this editorial in the paper the next day saying he's really got it wrong. He completely misread the audience. They're actually proud of it. They're very happy about it. Then, a generation later, and this longitudinal studies are good on this in terms of the benefits, there are three white communities who say, we just want to go back to, they don't say this, the effect is the differentiation. We're getting so close. We're getting to a point where we're so level, so equal. The black kids really are doing just as well, if not better in many cases, as the white kids. They're taking a step back. They take it to court. Ironically, it's a Reagan-appointed judge who says, oh, you can keep this program going, no problem, as long as you don't factor in race. Ah. That was kind of the point. Right. And just about every statistic that you can measure since they ended the program in the 2000, I don't remember when the Swan decision was, 2004, 2006, somewhere in there, things have deteriorated and are on pace to go back more or less to the way they were in 1970s, early 1980s. So as we're looking at hot button issues, it's like, what do we know about the underpinnings of this? What information don't we have? How curious do we need to get about finding out? And I was going to do this one instead, but it's so complicated that I'm not. But I was talking to a friend of mine who's an evolutionary psychologist on the trans women in sports, you know, controversies coming out of the Olympics. And he just walked me through this very complicated sexual differentiations that show up in people's lives that most of us are not aware of. And so our immediate response is, well, you know, that person looks like a man, doesn't pass the, you know, the eye test, you're out of here, you know, this is terrible. And that's much more nuanced, as things are, much more complicated than that. So what I try to leave folks with is, first, more books than they can possibly read, and articles, you know, to impress upon them some sense of humility. People really have been thinking about this stuff. Your instantaneous judgments are not the last word on what might be right or wrong, good or bad in these particular cases. And then some small sense of moral humility in which, you know what, I really don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know how many of you have been in that conversation. I'm in that conversation every day, where I'm halfway through it, I'm passionate, I'm worked up, I'm making my arguments, and it occurs to me, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I bet there are people who do, and I should probably learn what that is. I think if we can move more of us to that sort of intellectual humility, more of that position where a curiosity of mind, a sense of my first go-to response is, I'm not sure what I'm talking about. For me, that's the first step towards working actually to an answer, right? To finding a way to say, look, because we have to have an answer. Affirmative action was an answer in all the various programs. And then the Supreme Court decision of last year was an answer to the question of whether racism still exists, discrimination is still real and has negative effects, and what the best remedy for that is. If the best remedy is more information suggesting that we're not past it, that it's incumbent upon, let's say, progressive spiritual communities to keep working towards the values that you espouse.